here's the material we're going to have tonight, sir. Okay, I really appreciate Greg teaching in my absence on Sunday. I listened to the class. I thought he did an excellent job. One point that he brought out that has never occurred to me, and I like the way that he phrased it. I forget at what point in the class that he said this, but his comment basically was the strong has two choices. He can eat or he can refuse to eat. That's his option. But the weak only has one choice. And that is he cannot eat because he doesn't have the faith, he doesn't have the conscience to do that. I thought that was a rather unique way to sort of encapsulate the main idea of the text. And I really thought that was well put. I liked the way he brought that out. All right, we're going to pick up where we left off, or where you left off, I should say. That's about verse 9 in chapter 15, and the discussion will conclude in verse 13, so only a few verses to go tonight. We want to cover the rest of the questions. It's just two questions, numbers 57 and 58. And then we'll do the handout that was given out in class a few periods ago. That's page 40A. That's an additional sheet that you were asked to put in your folders. Anybody not have that handout tonight? I've got extra copies. If you would like one, I can make sure that you get one. And then after we cover the handout, which we won't spend a lot of time doing it, but we do want to cover it to some degree, and then we'll go back to the bottom of page 40 and do our application. As we've been saying, this is often the most controversial of the Roman letter applications. I wish that it weren't so. I wish the passage had not been as abused as much as it has through the ages, but it has. And so we'll talk about all that when we get to the end of class tonight. So we're at the very end of the application section. How a justified saint can live a life of faith by the grace of God, especially when he does not agree on specific certain issues with his brethren who have a different level of conscience, who live by different scruples. So Paul addresses a strong again as chapter 15 begins. We need to bear the infirmities or the weaknesses of those who don't have the strength the strong brother has. The strong always has a greater burden. To him whom much is given, much is required, Jesus taught in Luke chapter 12 and verse 48. Then in the last part of verse 2, as well as into verse 3, you'll see that Paul used Christ as an example of this very principle. Please others rather than please oneself. And he quotes there, you'll see, the 69th Psalm. That's in the end of verse 3 of chapter 15. And a good parallel passage to lay beside that would be the very familiar text in Philippians 2. We have this mind in us that was also in Christ Jesus. How he left he laid aside his heavenly privileges and took on the form of man, became a bondservant, and even died for mankind. Well, of course, it just means that he didn't think of only himself. He had to think of humanity. And that's the principle that Paul is illustrating, both in this text as well as the Philippian letter to those Christians. So then verse 4, off-quoted in Romans 15, verse 4, things written aforetime, written for our learning. Well, what aforetime passage was just quoted? Well, that's Psalm number 69, and so that's what Paul is using. And we always make the application with this passage. If New Testament saints can have a good working knowledge of the first covenant, in this case it'd be the Psalm 69 passage, but any Old Testament text, then that will help us, that'll give us hope through the Scriptures, patience and comfort. We can be what the Lord wants us to be. Obviously, that's the point that Paul's bringing out. The concluding exhortation starts in verse 5 all the way through the end of this section, which is verse 13. God, who gives His people perseverance and encouragement, can grant them to be of the same mind, be of the same voice, even when they differ in these matters of individual or specific scruples. And so the overriding principle in all this is what? It's unity. We need to strive for unity. And can people of God be unified even on these matters where they differ? Yes, and the main reason why is why? Well, love for one another, but there's something behind this issue, or these particular issues, with respect to God. God doesn't care. God is indifferent to these matters. As we've already studied in the 14th chapter, God has received both the strong and the weak brother. So if I always remember, here's my brother over here, he and I don't agree on a certain indifferent issue. All right. We should strive. We can talk about it. We should study. We should discuss it. But never lose sight of the fact that even though I may never agree with him, and that may be the case, I must not forget that who has accepted him? The Lord has accepted him. So if God can accept him, then that tells me what? I should be able to accept him. Because if it doesn't matter to God, it shouldn't matter to me that we don't agree in conscientiousness on this particular issue. And as Greg pointed out, and we did also in previous classes, we're not to confuse matters of faith in this chapter or this text with matters of the faith, where we're taught to contend for the faith. We can't have that. We can't have the faith to ourselves. We must convict people when they don't agree with the faith. But these are matters of personal faith, individual conscientiousness that we're dealing with. And we'll define all that when we get to the end of class this evening. Okay. First part of verse 7. Now, both the strong and the weak should accept each other the way that they are. Look how verse 7 begins. Paul says, "Wherefore accept one another, just as Christ also accepted us to the glory of God." So there's the blanket statement. Christ accepted us, we should accept one another. Then verses 8 and 9, before Paul begins quoting all these Old Testament passages, he gives a sort of a two-pronged answer. And this really fits in well with the overall setting we've tried to maintain throughout the entire study in Romans. Who's been Paul's audience? And don't just say the saints at Rome. Jews and Gentiles. The Roman church was made up of both, Jew and Gentile. And Paul had certain things to say to the Jew, and he did. And Paul had certain things to say to the Gentile, and he did. Well, look how he does this one more time before the end of the letter. After saying in verse 7, we should accept one another, verse 8, "For I say that Christ has become a servant to whom?" Circumcision, which would be Jews. And we'll further develop verse 8. And verse 9 says, "And for the Gentile." So he's a servant to the Jew. He's a servant to the Gentile. So one more time, Paul will try to blend these two ethnic groups together, because now they're saints in the same kingdom. Don't focus on our ethnicity as much as we need to focus on the fact that we're in the kingdom of Christ. So we should accept each other because Christ has accepted both, and Christ serves both the Jew and the Gentile. Verse 8 through the first part of verse 9. Now, in what way, as he lists here in the text, how does Paul stress that Christ serves the one of the circumcision or the Jew? What's he emphasize? There's one word that we're going to stress as important in that verse. Verse 8, "For I say that Christ has become a servant to the circumcision on behalf of the truth of God to confirm" what? Promises. That's important to the Jew. Well, what promises? Promises made to who? Abraham. You go back, those Abrahamic promises where it all began. "I'll make of thee a great nation, I'll give thee this land." Of course, the third promise was not just for Jew, but for all mankind. "In thee," or "in thy seed, shall all nations or the families of the earth be blessed." So Paul says, in that respect. Now again, as this letter would be read in the Roman assembly, and whoever was reading the letter, they come to this particular part. I mean, just the letter wasn't verse numbers like we've got. But as they would read these words, and they would say that word promises, these Jewish Christians would know exactly what Paul's talking about. Those Abrahamic promises. That's at the very heart of the fact that how this group of people became God's people. It had its start in those promises. So that's the key word right there, is those promises that were made to the fathers. But then how does he stress he's servant of the Gentiles in verse 9? They didn't have the promises, did they? That wasn't for them. So what's emphasized? The mercy. There we go. And with respect to the Gentile, he brings them mercy. Well, why did they need mercy? Didn't the Jew need mercy too? Well, he did. They were outside that first covenant, all wrapped up and involved in paganism and hedonism and all these false religions. And oftentimes, as we've seen throughout the New Testament, even some earlier in this letter, how would the Jew view the Gentile? Lower than a dog. That's right. Not even human. They just didn't count. And in the 11th chapter, we had that great discussion of the tree. The natural branch would fall off because of unbelief. But what could God do? Here's the mercy right here. What could God do with the wild olive branch? He could graft it in. God's able to do that. But He told the Gentile, now you beware. Because if God could graft you in, He could also do what? Well, you can also fall because of your own unbelief, but He could graft in again the natural branch, which was the Jews. So He talked to both groups in that passage. And so I thought this was rather interesting the way these two things were emphasized. The Jew, he emphasized the great promises made to the father Abraham. To the Gentile, he emphasized the fact how they needed mercy. And earlier in the letter, Paul had said that God is able to show mercy to whom He wills. That's God's right as sovereign. And that's how Christ served the Gentiles. So, Jews' promises, Gentiles' mercy. At the end of verse 9 then, what does Paul start to do? He then begins to give proof that Christ is, I think specifically, he's giving proof to the fact that of His mercy toward Gentiles. You read these Old Testament quotations, I don't see any of them referring to Jews. They're all pretty much referring to Gentiles. And so he quotes these texts. There are several. He's not just quoting from one source. He quotes David in 2 Samuel 22. He quotes the 18th Psalm. He quotes Moses in Deuteronomy 32. Again, Psalm 117, then the prophet Isaiah. And that's from verse 9 through verse 12. Let's read these texts. Let's see, Greg, if you'll read, just pick up there in verse 9, read that introductory statement with respect to the Gentiles, and then read the quotations down through the end of verse 12, please. Okay, so again, point after point after point, Paul was talking about this is how Christ has served the Gentiles, those who were outside of covenant, outside of the first covenant with the Hebrews. But that's how Christ can bring them into this great kingdom. So here was this one group of people, as Paul wrote in Ephesians 2, without hope of God in the world, outside of the covenant of God, they had nothing. And he brings them into the same kingdom in which he's got this other group of people who had the first covenant, to whom were the recipients of the Abrahamic promises, and what would have been the possibility that they would see differently on a whole host of issues? Very likely. They came from different backgrounds, different histories, different practices. One could do one thing and the other could not, and sometimes vice versa. And that's the whole gist of this chapter, to get them to see, all right, if you've come into this kingdom, you're a pagan, you're a Gentile, you're a heathen, priorly, God's accepted you if you've obeyed the gospel, and you're in. And here's the Jew. He knew God. He knew Moses. He knew Abraham. He knew all the prophets. He knew all that stuff that the Gentile did not know. But now he's in the same kingdom. And with respect to the same issue, that the Gentile could do something, the Jew could not. If the Jew could do it, the Gentile could not do it. All that's got to get ironed out. What governs all that? What Paul's taught in this great chapter. All of 14, at least through verse 13 of chapter 15. Okay. Now look at the last question. Let's look at verse 13, the concluding exhortation. When differing brethren faithfully follow Paul's teaching, not just in this verse, but this entire section as we've laid it out, gone through the whole thing, they can be filled with all joy and peace in believing. That's a quotation from the verse. And they can abound in hope. Verse 13 concludes, now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. And again, that begs the question, how is that even possible when people don't agree on some very heartfelt, conscientious issues? How is that even possible? Okay, it's not a doctrinal disagreement. That's correct. They also both have the mindset with respect to God, what? It doesn't matter to Him. He's received us both. We can work this out amongst ourselves. We can study about the issue. We can talk about it. But if push comes to shove, it's not required that we have to come to an absolute concrete agreement on this. Be patient, be understanding, be tolerant. All these principles should govern all that. And can differing brethren then coexist in peace? They most certainly can. The church doesn't have to split and splinter over such differences. Yes, you're right, Brother Lambert. That has been the cause of most division among brethren. So, just a couple of concluding points before we get to the handout. Conventional human wisdom, if we look at the issues we've been talking about, and if we just went with man's wisdom, and we see all the ways that men would hold different conscientious issues separately, human wisdom would say, what about the possibility of unity? That's pie in the sky. You're dreaming if you think that that can happen. So human wisdom would say, unity is not possible, and division, you would be so schismatic and so splintered that you wouldn't hardly have anything in common. Because as the point was made out in a couple of classes ago, our culture says, what about our rights? I have the right to do this and that, and I'm going to push for my rights. And I'm going to demand my rights, even at the expense of other people. But we don't live by human wisdom. We live by divine wisdom. Divine wisdom teaches that true unity can exist when differing brethren faithfully employ the principles found in Romans 14. It's entirely possible. Sometimes will it not be easy? Well, it could be kind of tough at times, yes. But if both are committed to truth, and as Freddie mentioned, if they're forbearing, they're tolerant, they love the Lord, they love each other, then what's bound to happen? They're going to get along. They can work together. They can make this thing work. Yes. Yes, it will. Can be. Yes. And before I get to your comment, Wayne, who's the brother with the greater burden here? Who's got to show the most maturity, the greater tolerance, the stronger brother? Can the weak become strong? Yes, he can. But as it sits today, in their differences, the strong must be tolerant, and he's got to be able to shoulder more of the burden. Yes, Wayne. Yes. Yes. When one obeys the gospel, he stops living for himself. No longer serve myself, but I serve the Lord. That's a good point. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's what Paul stressed in the early part of the letter, in chapters 1, 2, and 3, is that you guys are all in the same boat. You both had to obey the same gospel. You're on the same footing. Even though your backgrounds are just worlds apart, you're on the same level here. Both accountable to the same doctrine, both liable to live in the same way. And so there's reasons to be unified, as has already been stressed in the early part of the letter, especially when you come to this section where you have these specific issues where they may have conscientious scruples about one issue or another that may start to pull them apart, but the things that hold them together are stronger or greater than these individual conscientious issues. Vic, your hand was up. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. James chapter 1, right. Mm-hmm. 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 Right. 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 Yes. Right. 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 Yeah, and your point is where we are now. We must understand, okay, if we get the overriding principles of the text, that begs the last question. Right. What are legitimate Romans 14 issues? Okay. That's right. If we start having this discussion like you mentioned, when we talk to some of our institutional brethren, they start wanting to put things in here that clearly violate the will of Christ, then no matter how emotional it may get, the answer is that's not covered in Romans 14. That's covered in the doctrine of Christ elsewhere. And that's where we must go, to the places that cover these issues, not just dump it like it's a catch-all bucket in Romans 14 and we just agree to disagree. That's not proper in treating the passage. So what I want to do, turn to the handout, was page 40A. It's the separate handout that I gave you. And before we do the application, which is the last question on the bottom of page 40, I wanted to just give somewhat of a historical perspective to how much Romans 14 has been abused, even in prior centuries, not just in recent history, to show that sometimes, and I'm running the risk of making too many blanket statements here, but when I say we, sometimes we've not done as good a job as we should have and could have in properly, rightly dividing the word truth, as Vic just said, with respect to Romans 14. Here's just some examples. This is just to make the first statement there. Division over this chapter is not just recent. I mean, it's not. It goes way, way back. And this list is not exhaustive. This is just a few that I selected that I had in my notes. You may have others that are just as good as these and some of your own material. That would be fine as well. Numerous times, brethren have misused this text to justify something that doesn't really belong. Here's some examples. In the 1800s, Isaac Eric, if you do any historical reading in the days of the division among brethren, he was a big advocate for the use of the instrument. And guess where he went? He went to Romans 14. There's a lengthy quote that you see there before you. Look what he emphasized that they all agreed on. Things like what? The deity of Christ. So, you know, we can agree on that, and the necessity of baptism. So, I mean, this sounds so secular and so denominational. Let's just focus on what we agree on and let's just ignore where we have... That's not how we go about this. So even though there may have been unanimity among the believers at that time about Christ's deity and the necessity of baptism, he then said we must not dictate where Christ is not dictated. That was his take on it. Some of the brethren who are pushing for division over the instrument are guilty of murderous stifling of free thought and free speech. Translation, he was saying brethren who won the instrument were free to think and to pursue that. And others who were saying, no, we must not go that way, were stifling them and denying them that liberty or that right. So his solution was, we insist Romans 14 allows that very large liberty. Well, what do you think about that? Correct or incorrect? That's not right. Because does the doctrine of Christ instruct us about what to do with our worship in song or in music? We can turn to many passages. And one of them is not Romans 14. It's just not. Then a couple of three quick ones here. Again, in 1908, the Odie Briney debate over the instrument. Again, you'll see Briney's closing argument. He defended the instrument. He would make the same argument that Mr. Eric made. In the 30s and 40s, R.H. Bowles was a big advocate of the premillennial doctrine. And look at his rather succinct statement. We agree to disagree over premillennialism. It comes into Romans 14. Brethren, put that in this chapter. That's a flagrant abuse of Romans 14. Because that is such a doctrinal error that the Scripture does not endorse it in any shape, form, or fashion. In the 50s and 70s, Carl Ketcherside and others who were like him advocated what's been called the Unity and Diversity Movement or the Grace Fellowship Movement, where we disagree with denominational people out here, and where we differ, well, we'll just dump it in Romans 14. We can fellowship them. Well, what about that? That's not right either. That can't be right because of other passages that lead us in the opposite direction. Maybe one of the more, I want to say, famous or one of the more well-known ones, and it's the most recent that I've got on this handout, is what Brother Harold did in Christianity Magazine back in the late 80s. So this one's about 20 years old. And at the time, what was, if you remember, maybe some of you do, maybe some of you don't, it was well known among the brethren, Brother Haley's teaching on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. He wrote a book about it. And he even did some public preaching out in the West, in New Mexico and the California area, where his basic position was that the alien sinner is not amenable to the doctrine of Christ with respect to marriage and divorce and remarriage. He could marry and divorce any number of times before he becomes a Christian, one time, two times, 10 times, really, in theory. But when he comes to the Lord and obeys the gospel, then the spouse that he or she has, that's the one he's able to keep and must keep. But the prior divorces would not be, adultery would not be a factor. Well, that caused a big uproar among the brethren. Okay, now can we have Brother Haley for meetings? Can we fellowship Brother Haley? And some brethren kept saying, yes, we can. Look at all the great things you've done in the kingdom. And some said, no, he's a false teacher. Well, Brother Harold sought to defend Brother Haley. And he wrote, over 16 months, he wrote monthly editorials in Christianity Magazine on what he called the bounds of Christian unity. And his main point was to advocate that we have historically had these differences over Romans 14 throughout the ages as the religious people. And so he was pushing, and he said, I mean, I've got the arguments if you'd like to see them. Though I don't agree with Brother Haley on this issue, I can fellowship him as a brother. Why? Romans 14 was his point. His statement, Romans 14 covers matters of great doctrinal and moral import. By that he means Romans 14 is the place to go when you have differences over moral issues and or doctrinal issues. What about that? I'll tell you, brethren, that's error. Yes, that's right. So what I want to do quickly is look at the problem statement there. Let's say I want to put a doctrinal issue in Romans 14. Or I want to put some moral issue in Romans 14. Let's say I'm going to do that because I want to have fellowship with someone who holds the opposite view on this moral and or doctrinal issue than me. But I want fellowship with him so bad I'm willing to let Romans 14 be the unifying mechanism through which that happens. Well, if I can put a moral issue in there, then what can he do? He can put one in there as well. And if he holds the opposite moral view that I hold, I'm going to put mine in there. He's going to put his in there. You see the quandary we're in now. That's not going to work. So here's a quick example. I chose two issues. One is doctrinal. One is moral. Let's talk about homosexuality and adultery. Those are doctrinal and moral issues. Now that's why I want to say this to the end, because we've stressed the principles that's been found throughout the text. These 5 points at the bottom of this handout. These are principles that just come right out of the chapter that we've already established. Like, for example, number one, has God accepted the strong and the weak brother in the text? The answer was yes. Paul says. Okay. Let's put the issues of adultery and homosexuality in Romans 14. Let's say they go in there. If Romans 14 covers matters of great doctrinal and moral import, well, let's put them in there. Then let's just ask the obvious question. Will God accept the homosexual or the adulterer? Now, of course, if they repent, yes, but I mean them staying in their sin. The answer is no. He won't accept them. And see, that flies right in the face of what the chapter proclaims. Second question. Will God make the homosexual or the adulterer stand? No, he won't. In fact, what does he demand? You're going to have to stop that sinning, and then I can make you stand, because Paul has argued he makes both the strong and the weak brother stand in their personal private conviction on these matters. Paul said that. But as long as the person is going to stay in his sin, God's not going to make you stand in that. God wants you out of that sin. See, that doesn't fit the text. Number three, we have verse 6. Paul said both the strong and the weak. If the one eats, he eats to whom? He eats to the Lord. If he doesn't eat, he doesn't eat to whom?
the Lord. Paul made that statement. Okay. Can one practice homosexuality to the Lord? I'm not trying to be funny here. I'm just taking a statement right out of the text. Can one practice adultery to the Lord? Well, of course not. That just doesn't make sense. So see, it fails a certain textual test in my mind. It doesn't fit what Paul has argued. Number four. Absolutely, they did that. With their going to the priestesses or the prostitutes, the harlots, in the fornication that was rampant throughout the paganism. You're right, Freddie. Number four, are we to refrain judging homosexuality and adultery? What did the chapter teach us about judging? No judge. If you're the strong, don't hold the weak brother in contempt because he can't do what you can do. And if you're the weak brother, what did he say? No judging the strong. That's his scruples. You've got your scruples. He's got his. So no judging. Well, what about the adulterer or the homosexual? Is there to be some judging? For the sake of their soul? Absolutely. They need to be taught to come out of that. It's going to cost them their soul. And then verse 14. Paul said, I know that nothing is unclean of itself. Well, okay, he's talking about issues that you can put in Romans 14. Nothing's unclean of itself. So it could be argued that adultery and homosexuality are clean of themselves. Well, of course not. We'd have to have our head examined if we argued that. But see, that's what the text argues. And so there's just a quick list of five statements that we can just pull from the text and apply to Brother Harold's position that Romans 14 covers matters of great doctrinal and moral import. And that is a false statement. It cannot be true. It's not. Yes, Vic. Yes. That's correct. That's right. If he has spoken, he's not indifferent. We must learn what he has said then and live by that. If God has not spoken, he's left that to our individual consciences, then we might hold different views on that. But he's accepting of both because it doesn't matter to the Lord. I think it's a good way to put that. Okay. Now, back to the bottom of page 40. Yes, Wayne, go ahead. Yes. Apparently so. Yes. Yes. So you got one group says one thing? Absolutely. Not consistent application of the rules that would govern how to apply Romans 14. That's a good observation, Wayne. Okay, so let's go back to the bottom of page 40 now. Here's where the rubber hits the road. Here's where the tire hits the pavement here. So what goes in it? What are some legitimate Romans 14 issues? First, let me put up here what I think the chapter does not address. Well, we've already covered that, yes. But I've got some specific examples. Ones that typically get put in Romans 14. The covering is not a Romans 14 issue. I don't believe that it is. Why do I say that? Before you answer, do brethren differ on the covering? Sure we do. I mean, we have to have our heads in the sand to say that we didn't differ. We do differ. So does that mean that it's Romans 14 issue? No. Is the doctrine of Christ explicit on the covering issue? Whatever side you take for the moment, just remove that. Can we find something that God has said about it? We can. So if we differ on it, the place is to not to go is Romans 14. Where is the place to go? 1 Corinthians 11. We've got to go to that text and sort of hammer that out and see if we can come to an agreement on that. That's the place to go. But typically, or historically, we've seen, well, that must be Romans 14 because we differ. No, I don't think that goes there. Another issue, the Sunday PM Lord's Supper issue. Are we completely unanimous on that issue? No, we differ. This is a doctrinal issue. We have differences on that. So is that Romans 14? I don't believe that it is. Where's the place to go? Well, not just one, but one place to go would be the same chapter where Paul discusses the supper. And principles that outline how the supper is to be eaten and observed. Corinth, how she was doing it in many ways, doing it wrong and bringing division into the church. And Paul sought to correct all that. Plus, you could also look at some of the gospel accounts, I believe, maybe the passage in Acts 20 and verse 7 in the Acts record that gives us some principles on the supper. But historically, even though we put it there, that doesn't mean that it's a legitimate Romans 14 issue, I don't believe. So that's been done in the past. And then here's another emotional one. Carnal warfare. In fact, these three were mentioned in Brother Harold's articles, saying historically that's where we've differed over these issues, not just recently, but down through the decades we've differed on this. Can a Christian go and kill on the battlefield? Some say yes, some argue no. Well, since we differ, it must be Romans 14. I don't believe it is. I think we can find some passages in the gospel of Christ that I believe speak to this very issue. So, this list is not exhaustive, but these are just three of the main ones that you'll usually see or typically see when you maybe read some writing by some brethren or have some discussions among brethren about what might be Romans 14 issues. So I just want to at least cover that. So, now maybe you disagree with me on those three. I don't know. We can have that talk if you'd like. So, as we got 5 minutes left now, what would be, I'm going to emphasize the word legitimate Romans 14 issues. Well, I think circumcision would be one. Now, I don't mean in the way it was used in Acts 15. What those Judaizing brethren do, they said to the Gentiles, if you want to be saved, what's got to happen? You've got to be circumcised. I don't mean it in that way. But I mean it in this way. Let's say we convert a Jew. We study with a Jew and we convert him. Okay. He's now a Christian, but his conscience still might be wrapped up in what sort of things? Do I have my son circumcised? Well, does God care whether little male babies are circumcised or not anymore? God doesn't care. In fact, we can turn to passages where Paul, on one occasion, took Timothy and did what? Had him circumcised. And took Titus and what? Did not have him circumcised. So it must not matter because he did one way and someone else another way. So I think that would be a legitimate Romans 14 issue. God is indifferent to that. But this newly converted Jew may have some scruples about that because that's his background. Here's another one. Whether or not to marry. That's Romans 14 issue. Let's say we get lucky and convert a Catholic priest. Let's say we do. Well, what's he been taught all his life? Or a nun? We've got to be celibate. Well, does God care if you stay single or get married? I know he said it's not good for man to be alone. We can find that. But Paul stayed single, didn't he? He did. So they may have some scruples about that. You know, we may convert them. We may baptize them into Christ. But they still have this sort of a hang-up about, I'm not sure I can marry. Well, then don't marry. God's indifferent to that. I think that would be legitimate. Working on a Sunday. Now, I don't mean working and missing church. I mean, like, in the afternoon, between services. Something as simple as going home mowing your yard on Sunday. How does an average denominational person view Sunday? Well, it's the Lord's Sabbath. It's the Christian Sabbath. And that means what? No work. So they just can't bring themselves to mow. So let's say we convert our Baptist neighbor. And he's had this idea that I can't do any work on Sunday. But we went into Christ. Is there anything wrong mowing your yard on Sunday afternoon? I mean, are you violating the will of God if you do that? No. There's no violation of the will of God. But he might have a hard time doing that. Because he's always thought that seems to me to be so profane and so unholy. Well, then, what's his conscience say? Then don't mow your yard on Sunday. But if a brother did, where's the sin involved in that? There's no sin. Traveling on, a lot of things come into play. Let me read you a quote I got from Bill Hall's class notes I have in my files. He says, generally speaking, the issues we're trying to plug in here, more than likely, Romans 14 would apply to liberties in Christ which the newly converted one recognizes intellectually, but who is not ready emotionally to accept and practice them. That's a good way to put that. Intellectually, I've been taught, Okay, I can see where the gospel doesn't address that, but my conscience just hasn't caught up with that yet. And so I'm going to struggle with that. That's a good way to put that, I think. All right, just a couple of quick more. Some brethren have trouble playing innocent cards. Now, of course, I don't mean gambling. But playing innocent, they were reared in a time that there was this association with gambling, and so they can't play cards in good conscience. Well, now, does God care whether you play a good hand of rook or not? He don't care. But some cannot in good conscience play cards. Yes, in the playing card days. Yes, right. I understand. Yes, and so that really offends them. That wounds their conscience. And so if you're going to have a card party or a game party, well, is it wrong to play games and play cards? No. But how would you apply this chapter? Don't invite them. Don't shove it in their face. Those kinds of things. That would be honoring what Paul teaches in this chapter. You'd be mindful of their concerns about it. But at the same time, can they say to you, you can't play that game now? That's no, because the weak cannot judge the strong. If it's truly a matter of indifference to God. Dice, cards, I mean, whatever. Right. Some can and cannot exchange gifts on certain holidays. That's a real issue with some, and with others it is not. Does God care whether or not you exchange a gift, show an act of kindness to someone? Where's that a violation of the Scripture? But some have a conscientious scruple about, well, that there's some connection to some pagan holidays, and so we just feel like we cannot do that. Then that's fine. That's their conscience. That would be their scruples. But others can do that and it not wound their conscience. I believe that would be a legitimate Romans 14 issue. And then using a pitch instrument to lead singing, I think, is a Romans 14 issue. Now, by that I mean, I'm not saying those who would make the argument it's wrong for anybody to do it. It's sin to do it. Well, then nobody can do it. Then what about brethren that blow a pitch instrument? It'd be sin if they said nobody should do it, but some can and some cannot do it. So I think that would be because does God care? God doesn't care how we pitch a song. Some of them get up here and they don't use anything. They just start the song. Okay, that's fine. But some use a tuning fork. Some use a chromatic pipe. Some use these electronic little gizmos that you can buy. All those things are just aids to help us do what? Start singing. That's all they are. I think those would just be a small smattering of what I would say would be legitimate Romans 14 issues. Has the bell rung? I believe it has. Okay. So that brings to an end probably the most controversial section of the Roman letter. We have one class left that Sunday, Lord willing. We'll start in Romans 15, verse 14, and we'll finish the book. That's all of chapter 16 as well. That's lesson number 6 in your folders. Appreciate your good comments and your participation in the class.